Compliance and Title IX Committee meeting of Thursday, June 8th at 1:30 p.m. Roll call, please.
Chair Perkins.
Here.
Vice Chair Arascotta. Regent Boylan.
Aye.
Regent Cruz Crawford. Regent Del Carlo.
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Thank you. And with that, I'll open with public comment. Is there any public comment in Reno? Seeing none, is there any public comment in Elko?
There is no public comment in Elko.
Thank you. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
No public comment in Las Vegas.
Thank you. That brings us to number two, the consent items. I would like to entertain a motion.
So moved.
Thank you.
I'll second that. This is Regent Del Carlo. I'll second.
Thank you. The first, the motion was made by Regent Boylan, and the second was made by
yes,
Regent
ma'am.
Del Carlo. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? That motion carries. That brings us to the chair's report. I would like to thank Scott Anderson for his work with me and keeping me on the straight and narrow. And do you want to do the rest of it? Or okay, and I'll turn it over to Scott or Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Scott Anderson, Internal Audit Manager, for the record. So in the audit summary document, I've included a table of reports being presented today, which includes the updates on follow-up reports we just approved. As always, we'd like to thank the institutions that have reports being presented today. So the first one we have is the TMCC Disability Resources Center. So this audit focused on the process for how students register for and receive accommodations at the college. This included testing to determine that applications for services were submitted, intake meetings with DRC specialists were held in a timely manner, and that all relevant documentation, including medical documentation, was on file to support the accommodations offered. We also reviewed faculty and staff training, student outreach regarding DRC services offered, access to facilities, and protection of records, in addition to what you'd expect, like testing expenditures and equipment inventories. This was the first time this audit has been completed at TMCC. A similar review was conducted at Nevada State College last year. The audit was very clean, with only minor recommendations related to equipment inventories. The college and staff should be commended for their work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And that was item number four, the Disability Resource Center on
yes.
the TMCC. And that is for possible action. So if there's a motion.
I'll make a motion. This is Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo, for that motion. Do I have a second?
A second from Crawford, Cruz Crawford.
And that was a motion to approve, correct? Regent Del Carlo?
Yes, motion to approve.
Thank you, ma'am. And that was seconded by Regent Cruz Crawford. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? And that motion carries. Moving on to number five, network security at DRI.
Okay. The DRI network
Madam
security.
Chair.
I'm sorry,
Regent Boylan. Go ahead.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm a wee bit lost. What's happening? I was waiting for some other things to be taken care of, and we've jumped. Did you already say that we'd be jumping past those items?
No, there was the chair's report was for information only, and then we moved to the Disability Resource Center TMCC, which was item number four. And so now we're on.
Where was your? I missed you today. Where was your report?
It was very brief.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to just thank Scott, Mr. Anderson, for all his support.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for that. Moving to, continue with item number 5.
Thanks, Chair Perkins. For the record, Scott Anderson, Internal Audit Manager. So the network security audit focused on key control areas related to network security, including access controls, network segmentation, firewall and encryption configurations, patch controls, physical security, training, and policies and procedures. As indicated in the report, no material control issues or deficiencies were noted, and the overall control environment was considered good. Recommendations for improvement include updating policies and improving oversight related to decentralized systems operating on the network, updating policies and procedures to enhance external stakeholder risk management, establishing configuration standards for key network systems, and formalizing, related change management policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for that. That was for possible action also. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate it. Talking about access controls, I'm sure this is the spot to ask this. When he talked about access controls and all these things, I really would like to know what the access controls are to our board handbook and guidelines, etc. Who has access to those to make changes? And is there a trail that shows us who went in, what time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So you talk about access control, and I know this is drilling down deep into one particular area. So how would we get that, and how would the regents be aware of it, all the regents, not one or two? Is that all right, Madam Chair, to ask?
Okay. Can you clarify the question for me?
Okay. I would like to know, talking about access controls, who has access to our guidebook and the other board principles, etc. The two books that we have, and our changes, etc. Who makes those, and who has access to those, and who can make those? Because I honestly feel sometimes that there have been changes made just to suit. And this is a big accusation, and I'll stand by it, to suit certain people in the control of how regents do their work. So I would really like a report on how access is given or how things are controlled in our two policies and guideline books. Who is it and who all has those?
Okay, to summarize. You're talking access control for our handbook?
Yes, ma'am, and the policies and handbook.
Okay.
Just some two simple things. Maybe the lawyer can tell us if that is the right question to ask you, because we are talking about access control. This is what I'd like to know, ma'am.
I know. I think I understand what you're asking.
Thank you, ma'am.
These are the access controls that, like, for sign-ons and logins for the for DRI, not necessarily access and control for our policies and handbooks. So I will put your question into new business, if that's okay with you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
No, you are totally right. I'm not thinking correctly today again, so I appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
Well, you always have the great questions, but I thought this was your area of expertise. With the computer.
You are too kind.
Thank you. So with that, is that a motion, kind sir?
Oh, that's not a motion. That was really a question. I didn't make a motion, ma'am. Sorry.
In that case, I'd like to entertain a motion for approval for the network security DRI.
You're all approved. I mean, I make the motion now.
Thank you. That was a motion made by Regent Boylan and seconded by Regent Cruz Crawford. All excuse me. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? And that motion carries. Thank you. Moving on to number 6, audit compliance and Title IX committee updates. And this is for information only.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Scott Anderson for the record. Just want to give a couple quick updates today. The first involves Title IX. So we had planned on giving a presentation today from one of our campus experts on the new Title IX regulations that are coming out soon. These proposed regulations were issued last July and have been under a public review and comment period. And it was thought that the final regulations would be released this spring. However, this is not expected to occur now until this fall, around October. So we thought it would be best to wait until those final regulations have been presented before we give an update. So we'll stay abreast of the timeline and plan to provide some information on this topic at a future meeting. So the second item I wanted to talk about today was the incident management system, the INCHI incident management system. At the June and December committee meetings, we have typically given some updates related to the INCHI hotline and incident management system that was established through NAVEX Global in 2019. For a brief background, reports submitted through the incident management system are initially assessed by the chief internal auditor or designee, who determines the nature of the report and whether an investigation is warranted. If so, it is further determined whether an investigation will be handled by the chief internal auditor, legal, or referred to a subject matter expert at the INCHI entity involved. Each spring, NAVEX issues its hotline and incident management benchmark report. The report is a compilation of over 1.5 million reports received by over 3,400 organizations. In the past, we have compared INCHI to some of the metrics provided in the report. So with that in mind, I have a few data points to share. So regarding volume, at the December meeting, we reported that a total of 179 cases had come through the hotline since inception in January of 2019. This included 59 new cases in the 6 months since the prior update was given in June of 2022. As we noted, the 59 cases represented a significant increase in activity, going from about 6 reports per quarter during the COVID era to 30 per quarter during the last 6 months of 2022. This was consistent with the benchmarking report, which stated that that 2022 overall saw the highest levels of reporting since inception of the report. It is thought the increase is due primarily to the return to the traditional work environment and perhaps a greater willingness of reporters to speak out about workplace issues. Since our reporting back in December, we've seen 37 new submissions, or about 18.5 reports per quarter. So although volume remains higher than during COVID, it has decreased some in the first half of 2023. As far as anonymous reporting, this is one of the important features of the incident management system, is the ability to share potential concerns anonymously. Since inception of the hotline, 122 of the 216 reports filed, or about 56%, have been anonymous. During 2022, however, the anonymous rate was about 71%, an increase from around 30% in 2021. This is consistent, although a much larger change than the benchmarking report, which indicated the anonymous rate increased from 50 to 56% in 2022. It is suspected the increase is due to a more cautious workforce following the Great Resignation era and related concerns about job security and the economy. It is interesting to look at the 36 new reports filed in 2023. Only 11 have been anonymous, or 30%. So it looks as if this trend is reversing for the current year and reporters are more willing to disclose their identity. So we've kind of had a up and down effect in this anonymous reporting era in this last 3-year period. The last thing I wanted to mention was reporting categories. So reports submitted through the hotline are categorized based on the nature of the submission. These categories include accounting, auditing, and financial reporting, business integrity, human resources and diversity, environment, health, and safety, misuse or misappropriation of assets, and other. In 2022, over 60% of reports received through the hotline were classified as human resources related. This was an increase from 2021, when just under 50% were HR related. The increase correlates with the benchmarking report, which indicates the percentage of HR cases increased from about 50% in 2021 to 54% in 2022. This seems to make sense with the shift in workforce dynamics back to the office environment and the corresponding increase in employee interaction during this period.
Scott, if I can interrupt, Mr. Anderson, if I can interrupt you. I believe there's a question from Regent Cruzcroft.
Yeah, I've been, sorry. I am lost on the document. Can you let us know where this information is? Because I haven't seen any of those. I'm trying to write them as fast as I can.
I didn't have a document for a reference item.
Oh, then that makes sense.
Just a verbal.
Got it. Sorry. Okay. I apologize. I'm just trying to write down these numbers, but is can we get that information afterwards,
please? Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that concludes my remarks. We'll continue to work on improving our processes and the information we provide to this committee. Certainly welcome any input you may have. Thank you.
And thank you for that report. Any questions? Regent Cruz Crawford.
Yes. Is this information posted publicly somewhere of the number of cases reported and timelines for processing complaints and outcomes?
Are you referring to the benchmarking report or the NCHI?
The Title IX or complaints that you originally, the NCHI report, I guess?
Mr. Anderson?
The NCHI report isn't in public.
Okay.
No. Okay. If you would like that information, we could provide it to you.
Is there any way to do that, like, anonymously, or would give information, like, just number of cases? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, I could provide that to you. Yeah.
Okay. And there's no way we post that publicly or anything for data?
Not that I'm aware
of. Data dashboard or anything?
I have not seen that posted publicly, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, could you explain, like, the difference between the benchmark report and the NCHI report?
Well, the benchmarking report is a compilation of reports that 3,400 different organizations have submitted. I assume they all have the NAVEX platform, so they compile all these reports that they get, and they do some reporting on those 30, you know, I think it was 1.5 million total reports from 3,400 different organizations. So I have that report if anyone would like that. That would be, you don't want that? I mean, it's not real long. But there is some useful information in there if you're interested in reading it. And the NCHI statistics are just, you know, the information that we keep internally. We receive the cases that we receive through the hotline. So we just compare ourselves to that benchmarking report.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. Any other questions? Regent Carvalho.
I can wait since Regent Boylan is on this committee.
That's very, thank you. Regent Boylan, go ahead, sir.
Oh, you are too kind, ma'am. Yeah. Mr. Anderson. Don't mind me calling you Scotty, but just maybe you, everybody else knows this and I don't. What is process, you know, when someone wants to bring to light that something they're afraid to do so, like me, I'm always scared of things. What happens? Do they write to you? Do they write to board members? And then you take that information and you go investigate it? You know, the steps. How does it work to where we can say, okay, we took care of this complaint that this NG member had, or student, or anybody? What are the steps? Is there an audit compliance? I'm on the committee, I know, but is there an audit compliance, you know, worksheet or work form or something you have that people can find on the internet and say, well, oh, now I've got it. I can make my issue, investigate. Is there something, do you have those steps? How would we do it? Let's say I was being bullied by somebody. Happens all the time, I know. But I was being bullied and I wanted to let you know about it, or let the chair, because she's the chair of the audit. What are the steps? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm making it a rigmarole, but it's really very simple. What do I do?
Thank you, Regent Boylan, for the question. I'm referring to the hotline that is on our NCHE website. There's a phone number there and a portal where, you know, whoever the complainant is can submit their issue through. And those issues then, get submitted through that to the Internal Audit Department first. And then we evaluate those complaints, issues, whatever, as they come through and determine whether it should be something referred out to a campus, or if it's something that we can handle internally by audit department in collaboration with maybe some other folks, like, someone on the campus, for instance, or legal or something like that. It's a triage process, I guess. They come in, we review, we determine the best way to handle. And about two-thirds of those that come through are referred out to the campus to a subject matter expert, we call it, that has expertise in the area and would best be able to investigate or review the matter. So, hope that answers your question.
It kind of does. So then the steps are, it'll go to the SME, and then they'll give you a report, and then do you report this to the board, to the committee? Or it's just kept within the audit, with you and your people. I understand it's tough,
yeah. But
I'm trying to figure out then what happens, or it disappears into the black hole of nobody cares and forget about.
Thank you for the question. If we refer it out to a campus, we follow up with the campus. So we ask them when we refer it to provide us with an update when they have done something with it. And then that information comes back to us. We update. We have like a tracking log. We update that log with the information they provided. I'm not sure about reporting these cases to the board. I can't remember if my predecessor was doing that in the past. It could have been. But certainly if anyone, any of the regents would like some of that information, I believe that's something that we could do. So,
thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it. Didn't mean to put you on the spot or anything, but I learned something. Thank you so much.
That's okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Pullen. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Just to add to what Mr. Anderson said, in the past, when we started this anonymous hotline, periodically, Joe Sunbury would come to the board and give an overview of a report, nothing specific of names or anything like that, but just how many were received, how they were resolved, and that kind of stuff. So we are used to seeing that come, and I'm sure when we get his replacement in place, then we can go back to that too. And if someone else can remember that's been on this board for a while, maybe, I'm going to say maybe it was like once a year he would come and do that. And I'm really pleased to hear what you had to say, Mr. Anderson, because it sounds to me like the word's gotten out on this anonymous hotline, because, you know, anything starts, it's usually nobody knows about it, but it sounds to me like people are using it, which I think is a good thing, and it's what the intention is. And then, you'd get out to your subject matter experts and then back to us. But I think it's between Regent Perkins, chair there. You can tell me. I mean, I believe Mr. Sunbury's position and you would go over more details, but for the board as a whole, we would just get more of a generalization. So thank you.
Thank you, Regent DiCarlo. You are absolutely right. I think we get that once a year. I believe it was once a year that we get that report that says we get so many phone calls. These were cleared up. These are still in process. We just did that in March. Did we do that one in March?
I don't think he did do that in March.
So it's coming up on the next one.
Yeah, okay. Probably.
Thank you for that. Regent Cruz Crawford.
Yes, Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. I did want to share a couple things that we do for bullying reporting in the K-12 space, and maybe some of it might be something that we could adopt here. So just wanted to share. We have two bullying reporting sources. One is as a building principal or administrator in the building, anytime there is an incident, we log that on our Infinite Campus. And we select if it's bullying. If it is bullying, it's public knowledge in every school, and it's part of our Nevada report card. It's really helpful for me as a principal because I get to see, like, is there big disparities between schools? And maybe it's just not, sometimes I put in things wrong that shouldn't be bullying or should be bullying. And we get to have those conversations. I don't know if that would be something that would be useful, you know, for organizations, because it definitely is something that's useful for myself. And then we also have Safe Voice, which is another reporting system, and that information is public too. So I did want to share, there is ways to share publicly, and it is useful. I mean, things are going to happen, but the more, I think the more information that we have helps us fix problems, so the most transparent we can be. So just wanted to share that. If there was any way that we could be more transparent with this data, I would love that.
I will transfer that to new business.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for, you just be like.
Never. But one of the reports that you mentioned, like the bullying, for example, I believe that comes through the securities department or the securities committee, where they give reports about campus incidents. So that's kind of, this is specifically with Title IX. I mean, specifically, that's kind of the difference. Does that make sense? But your idea is excellent about having the report come back to us. Regent Carvalho, who's been so patiently waiting.
Thank you, Chair Perkins, and like I mentioned, I realize I'm not a member of this committee, but I appreciate the indulgence. First, I just did want to make ask a clarifying question. The anonymous hotline and website is available to employees and students. Is that correct?
Yes, and anyone else.
Okay.
Really. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So obviously there are some limitations to what we can report back out to the board in terms of privacy of both our employees and our students. So, but I agree with you that we have had reports in the past that gave high-level numbers of the status of the complaints and who was making those complaints. My other question, and I don't know if I see somebody in the audience that could answer this from a system office perspective, but I wonder, When we get information like this and it's shared with the chancellor's office or the system office, is there a nexus between the results of this information and perhaps human resources or somebody that can kind of parse this information and say, hey, this is an area that maybe we can work on something similar? What I'm thinking of is maybe like a results of a climate survey. And I feel like in a way this is similar to that. So I was wondering if there were any efforts to do that. And also, I also wonder what, and maybe this is really getting in the weeds in psychology, what does an anonymous response kind of, does that mean that it's a healthy work environment or not a very healthy work environment? And so I'm curious, not that I want to remove that. I think it's very important to have an anonymous way to report issues. But I wonder, what does this, if we can glean anything from this, what does this mean for our system and how well we are taking care of our students and employees? I just wondered, and like I said, maybe there's not somebody that could really answer that question right now, but what is the nexus between internal audit and like perhaps HR or the chancellor's office?
Thanks for the question. I'm pretty new at this, so I've only been dealing with this for about since the transition. I would say, we do, like I said, a lot of the cases are referred out. So there is some back and forth amongst those departments that we do refer these cases to. So in that sense, I would say there is a nexus because we're communicating with them about what's happening. So I don't know if that answers your question, but other than that, I'm not sure, it's pretty much just, the day-to-day activity of working through the submissions that come through.
I appreciate that. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. I know you are new to this role. I think I'm thinking more in terms of trends and research into what this might mean and where we can improve how we do business with our employees and our students.
That's a good point. Probably something that we do need to look at as we, evaluate these cases, that come through. Identifying trends and areas where we might be able to improve things.
And that sounds like another new business item. Thank you for that question. That was very in-depth. I like that one. Is there any other questions?
What about mine? You said
ours was in-depth. Yours was in-depth too. Yes, they've been very, very well thought out questions that bring a nuance to the audit committee that has not been seen before. And that was for information only. So now that brings us up to number 7. Is Matt going to present? Oh, there he is. Okay. And Matt's going to present this one, and this is also for information only.
Great. For the record, Matt Unterman from Grant Thornton. We do have some slides. I just want to make sure, are those up within the room?
Yes, they are, sir.
Wonderful. Great. Well, first of all, I just wanted to start off by thanking everyone today. Thank you, Chair Perkins, Mr. Scott Anderson, the committee, as well as the regents in total. We're of course, thrilled to serve you and also thrilled to have the opportunity to speak holistically about what's been happening in the world of higher education. This is our third annual presentation on the state of higher education. And for those of you that might not remember me, I think I set last year the Nevada state record of PowerPoint slides in a 35-minute presentation. I think it was about 75, give or take. I see some nods. I'm not going to take the same approach today. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I promise to bring the energy and enthusiasm that I've done the last couple of years, and I've brought a friend today. I am a partner in the practice and the leader of our consulting practice to higher education. And I brought Dennis Marone, who's another partner in the practice, and he actually leads our industry for higher education nonprofits. And so he and I will be tag teaming this presentation. So very excited to have my friend and colleague Dennis with us today. We do have some slides. We anticipate about 40 or 45 minutes of a presentation with some opportunity for maybe 10 or 15 minutes at the end for Q&A and dialogue with the committee as appropriate. We will go ahead and present the agenda if we can go to the next slide, just to talk you through what we're, I guess one more slide, please. Wonderful, thank you. So this slide talks about the agenda that we're planning to cover today. I'll start with some opening remarks, queuing up Dennis for, in general, our higher education industry outlook. And then I will close with some investing in education. Again, we have some Q&A at the end, should the committee be interested. We also just wanted to share with the committee, obviously this is a one-on-one presentation we're doing to you all, but we do give back to the higher education community in a variety of ways. On the right-hand side of the slide there, there's a number of public webcasts that we offer should you or anyone watching be interested in that in a future date. So next slide, please. So 2023, this is the state of higher education in 2023, but frankly, we have presented the last couple of years on the state of higher ed, and those topics are still out there. And so we thought we would actually begin with a presentation of what we talked about last year in 2022. We talked about three categories of things happening in the world of higher education. We talked about the need to create an equitable and sustainable future, meaning growth, navigating what we were calling the Great Reshuffle, which is a series of people moving between institutions or across industries. We're seeing continued evolution there in terms of human resources challenges, and strengthening the campus. Those are the three themes we talked about last year. We talked about many, many topics, DE&I, ESG, educational equity, workforce strategies, hiring and retaining talent, leadership strategies, student preferences, just driving a whole set of change within the world of higher education. And I would say last year we talked about, obviously, an interesting period over the last 3 to 5 years with the pandemic and various items. We're also coming up to another interesting period with the enrollment cliff and also just the changes in customer preferences that have been realized over the past few years. I dare say the last 5 years have had more change in the world of higher education than the prior 20 to 25. You could keep going probably because there was a significant amount of change in the last 3 to 5 years. And I also anticipate a fair amount of change happening. The next slide, please, talks about why is there change happening and what areas are people, higher ed institutions investing in. They're primarily investing in two areas. They're investing in growth and investing in infrastructure. Now, let me just say, you all know me from prior years. I'm someone, I obviously deal with higher education nonstop, but I do tend to use language that may not always be used in the industry, like growth. I believe that institutions and higher ed as an industry has been growing for a number of years, but we don't always use that term, which can seem a little commercial or for-profit, but I would encourage us to really embrace that term of growth, because that is something that I think we all really should be seeking. Now, what does growth mean? That can mean something very different in our institutions than in a for-profit enterprise. So growth in a world of higher education could be growth in mission. It need not be, but also could be growth of financials. Could be growth of revenue, growth of margin, et cetera, growth of programs, growth of students. All these things are growth, and none of them are antithetical to mission and our objectives as higher education institution. So we're seeing a number of institutions invest in growth by looking at their missions and how well they're serving their missions, to be developing strategic plans and action plans and positioning within a modifying, changing higher education landscape, and develop, I'll put these in quotations, various customer strategies or product strategies. Again, these are not two terms we don't typically use in the world of higher education, but I would very much encourage us to embrace those terms, thinking about our stakeholders as customers, thinking about what we provide as a product, and really trying to consider how we can collectively, not just in the state, but also across the country, up our game in terms of how we serve our current and potential customers and deliver on our products. Obviously, many institutions are investing growth by looking at financial performance and operational efficiencies. We're seeing an uptick in mergers and acquisitions and joint ventures and various transactions to really combine forces. Now, the other side, investing in infrastructure is not distinct from growth. And in fact, many times organizations are investing in infrastructure in order to enable growth. Because what was seen over the pandemic was the idea that it was actually very, very difficult to operate remotely. Very, very difficult to operate without adequate access to systems or our campuses. And frankly, there are some challenges from a risk management perspective. So many different lenses taken on infrastructure, investing in risk management, reserves planning, just general future readiness, frankly, board governance, which, trying to up our game as boards, not saying for this board, but just in general, to look at this as really an operational excellence sense holistically. Of course, in the weeds operations too, grants and fundraising, finance, procurement, HR, communications, risk management, all of these towards a sense of efficiency and effectiveness to really up our game as a goal in and of itself, but also to serve the idea of strategy and growth. Now, so there are a series of investments that are being made, and I think it's probably a bit of a silly question, but the question is, why are we investing? We're investing in growth, we're investing in infrastructure, we're doing that to better serve our missions, we're doing that to elevate our institutions, and we're doing that to serve our students, our potential students, and in this situation, to serve our state. Now, if you can go to the next slide, please, this is the positioning of the presentation. I covered some materials last year, and I'm going to kind of cover them again. We did them very quickly, and I think they are relevant today. So why do we invest in making our institutions better? Why do we as a state invest in higher education? There's clear return on investment for investing in higher education, local job creation, better health outcomes, frankly, tax revenue, civic engagement, research and development, economic growth. Education lifts people up and it lifts communities up and it lifts states up. That's really a lot of the reason why we go to school, why we invest in ourselves, and why we as regions and why we as a state invest in the world of higher education. Now, there's a series of charts and graphs here, one on the right, speaking about poverty rates, those with a high school diploma versus those that have a bachelor's degree or higher, you see the extreme distinctness there. Now, in the next couple of slides, we'll see some other charts, which again, are similar to what I referred to last year, but I wanted to kind of make this case a bit clearer as we think about how do we make investments in the state, how to make investments and move higher education forward to better serve our state. So next slide, please. So these are two more charts, kind of evidencing the same thing, but taking a different lens. On the left-hand side, by the way, the source here is Nakubo and the College Board. Over their lifetimes, bachelor's degree holders make significant contributions to their communities, ergo their states, through local economies, through local taxes, annual charitable giving, all kinds of ways to lift everyone up. And also, college graduates are less likely to participate in public assistance programs, a well-known fact. Now, the next slide, if you wouldn't mind pushing to the next slide, is another couple stats here. People with a college education are more likely to volunteer to give back, and college graduates are more likely to vote. But these are all just a series of ways to actually quantitatively evidence that post-secondary education is really serving the individuals, serving the communities, serving the state. So again, why am I bringing this up? Okay, I'm bringing this up because it is a time across all the states that we're thinking about how do we make investments in our states. I'm a higher education guy. Dennis is a higher education guy. Everyone on the regions are, cut from the same cloth. I would urge us to think about higher education as a very, very important tool towards investing in our states. And I believe a number of states are doing this. And I would ask the regions to consider to what degree we're investing in our state through education. I've spent a few years with you through these talks. I know we're not close friends, but I hope I'm close enough to you to kind of ask some challenging questions for your consideration, right? So we'll go to the next slide, which has some numbers that, well, they're not so optimal, but they are what they are, and it's data is data, and it gives us an opportunity to consider. So in 2008, the Lumina Foundation committed to catalyzing post-secondary attainment, setting a national goal of 60% attainment of post-secondary attainment by 2025. Likely, that goal will not be achieved by 2025, at least. We're currently at about 54% on a national level. You'll see the state distribution here in different colors. Nevada is not yet at 60%. None of the states really are. Nevada is unfortunately the lowest in the nation for post-secondary attainment today at almost 44%, 43.9%. Now, if you think back on the prior slides of the things that post-secondary education does for human beings as individuals, for their families, for their communities, for the state, it's worth considering what should that number be in the state of Nevada? What should that say? What should that number be for Nevada as a state? What should that number be in terms of all the people we're trying to serve in the state of Nevada? Okay. On the right-hand side, it shows some counties, which is probably not a surprise to you in terms of this overall distribution, but it is, there are some changes on a county-by-county basis. Now, again, why am I bringing this up? This is the idea of how do we make investments in the world of education? What are the payoffs? And what are our roles as the regions in doing so? So the next slide quantifies the investments that are made. And again, these slides are actually, this graph was actually presented last year, and actually this chart is last year's chart. It's from the 2021 numbers, it's a couple of years lag, it's produced by SHEO. And I will say this and the next slide have been, the numbers have been recently released in, with the 2022 numbers, but frankly, the numbers don't change that much for Nevada as a state. And so we published these to you, I think about a month ago with the pre-read. So we'll stick with the 2021 numbers because directionally they're the same. So this is chart talks about the appropriations and net tuition revenue per student FTE by state for 2021. Again, the 2022 number is about the same. We see Nevada at the low end there. Again, it's kind of, not the best place to be, and I feel somewhat sheepish pointing it out, but it is presenting, I would say, an opportunity. It's an opportunity to consider where should this be, what kind of investments should we be making to benefit the state, right? And every state makes its own decisions. I would say what is happening now across the states is they are making decisions about how they invest in their society, their economies, and their growth, okay? The next slide, please, looks at this a little bit differently. It breaks out the appropriations on the left and the net tuition on the right. You see in both the state of Nevada, definitely lower than the average, definitely towards the bottom. And again, these numbers don't change that much in 2022. So this is a place to consider what investments are we making in our state through the tool, through the mechanism of higher education. I feel like I've probably made my point in a bit of a heavy-handed way. Last year, I was incredibly brief with this point, but again, I do think this is interesting for your consideration. And I'll look at the next slide and sum up my first section and turn it to my colleague, Dennis. There's three questions that I think are useful for any state to ask. This is not particular to you all, but just for any state or any board or regions to consider. Where are we as a state currently? What is our ideal future? Where would we like to be? We're currently here. We do want to change. We want to go to a different place. How do we do that? What barriers are inhibiting our state's ideal future? Pretty simple question, incredibly hard to answer. And what investments in education are required to realize that future? I mean, these are three simple questions, but effectively three incredibly important questions to drive ourselves forward as a state. And you being regents have an opportunity to really consider these questions. So this is pretty heavy of a start. I'm going to pause with my presentation, turn it over to my colleague, Dennis Marone, leader of our national higher education industry. And he's going to share some just charts and graphs and stats across higher education in general to provide you some insights as to what's been happening holistically in higher education. Then I'm going to come at the end and kind of pull things together. So over to you, Dennis.
Scott, if you don't mind. Scott, if you don't mind, is there any questions at this point from any regent present? Regent Cruz Crawford.
I know it's Regent Cruz Crawford for the record. I know it was addressed in a couple slides. It was a four bachelor's degree or higher. But for the slide with the counties, is that our associate degrees counted in that? Or is it just bachelor's or higher for the Nevada counties?
So for the record, Matt Unterman from Grant Thornton. I actually will need to check on that. It's a great question. I believe, and I'd be happy to get back to you, I believe as Lumina established its initial goal, it was meant to be a bachelor's attainment. But frankly, as we got closer and closer to not attaining, there was some reflecting on that goal and its potential that associates are currently included. I would say it's a very good question. So frankly, there's a gap regardless, but I respect the question and what's behind it.
Yeah, because we know that a lot of our, first of all, I just want to thank our rural institutions too, because you're doing a lot of the hard work, WNC and TMCC and GBC, thank you for carrying those areas. But yeah, I think if we could get the numbers on that, unless that's just a way too big of a lift, I would like that. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Any other questions from anyone present, any member present? Okay, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, so for the record, this is Dennis Marone with Grant Thornton, and if we can move forward to the next slide. Okay, we can continue forward from there. So as Matt had mentioned, I just wanted to give you kind of like an overview of really what's happening across the higher education landscape. And so we can move forward to the next slide here. Okay, so you're gonna hear a lot of information over the next 15 minutes or so as I walk you through these slides. And certainly I'll leave time for some questions and comments and perspectives from some of the regents. But in terms of just framing thematically what you're going to hear, I think they would fall into roughly some of these five categories that we've presented here. In part, there's varied outlooks for higher education, whether you're talking about publics and private institutions, and I'll talk about both collectively, unless I specifically say one over the other. But I think the varied outlooks really stems from the end of the pandemic-related relief funding, and I'll talk more about that on the second slide that follows here in a moment. But I think many institutions are still grappling with the macroeconomic environment, and we don't really know exactly where it's heading. There's certainly been capital market volatility, with many institutions have been challenged by, in part through either a debt capital, the cost of capital for those institutions that have entered into debt and levered up during the period of COVID. It was a much different climate pre-COVID than it is today. And then also uptick in operating expenses. And you'll hear a lot about that as part of my remarks today. That has certainly strained operating budgets of institutions. It somewhat runs, it puts a challenge to what Matt shared earlier about how institutions are investing in their operations, their plant, their pedagogy, their institution overall. In terms of consolidating expenses, the second item here, you know, a higher education actually did a fairly good job of reacting to the early period of COVID, toggling between the in-person to the hybrid or total instructional via online platform. To that point, institutions learned a lot about what they do well, and they were actually quite introspective as an industry in saying, you know, this is something that could potentially provide an additional revenue stream for our institution. And here we said, we just make the comment that it can be credit positive. That means that it just ultimately strengthens the capacity of an institution to provide for its debt obligations and service its existing debt. But the cost of moving or promoting an online delivery platform in place of in-person, or even allowing that as a viable option for the institution, can cannibalize existing programs and revenue streams. And also the cost of sharing, putting on those programs with outside service providers, continues to be very costly for most institutions that have to rely on outside vendors to support that delivery. In terms of consolidation, nothing new here. There's always been a tremendous amount of chatter within the industry about consolidation. There has been a good amount of consolidation of institutions over the past 5 years. But when we think in totality about the number of institutions, both public and private and for-profit enterprises alike, you know, there's probably more than 5,300 institutions in the nation right now. And so when we saw roughly 50 institutions either merge or go out of business altogether, you know, it was somewhat trivial within the context of the entirety of the higher education landscape. But nonetheless, it's something that we expect will continue. And it's taking different forms, many more mergers and many institutions. Again, to my point about being introspective, what programs, what really is aligning with their goals in terms of how they want to promote and differentiate themselves amongst peer and aspirant organizations. And then finally, as we look at today's presentation and I share my remarks, and you heard some of Matt's already, this is all forward-looking. We're really trying to telegraph what we expect will be the trends that either have emerged or that we expect to emerge that institutions will have to deal with. And to that point, as I'm speaking with audit committees and boards, talking much more about strategic planning, but it's not the traditional type of strategic planning, much shorter term horizons. We're only looking at 3 to 5 years in terms of the plan and the business imperatives that are included therein. And they're doing something that's actually demonstratively different. They're lining up the resources today to propel and promote and accomplish those objectives. So they're not necessarily waiting on the money to come in the future. And in order to accomplish and really build out structured and well-developed and intentional plans, they're doing much more financial modeling and forecasting as an institution. And they're creating scenario planning and assumption banks, and they're toggling with those assumptions much more frequently than ever before. What if is a much more common discussion that we're hearing amongst finance committees that certainly we've been speaking with. Let's move to the next slide and actually dig into a little bit more about what the rating agencies are saying. Let's start with Standard & Poor's. And to my opening comment about the substantial federal emergency funding to higher education. And in fact, I think this number is actually a little bit understated. I think in some of the articles that I've read, the amount of federal resources that were surged to colleges and universities over the past 3-year period probably tops $175 billion. And that's a gulp and gasp moment, no doubt. And the majority of those monies actually went towards public institutions. Certainly private institutions receive their fair share of that support. But again, public institutions, as they hold, you know, or they actually enroll the greatest number of students nationally. The return to campus learning in person has led to increased tuition auxiliary revenues. And the point here is that auxiliary revenues tend to be the most profitable stream for an institution. For most institutions, auxiliary activities like room and board represent about 10 to 15% of their overall revenue base. But from a profit perspective or margin contributing perspective, they are much more of the strongest level of revenue sources for an institution. So it was critical for institutions to get their students back on campus, fill the dorms, and that helped a great deal with relieving some of the strains of the operating performance. You know, in terms of highly selective institutions, they continue to receive, you know, really a bumper crop of applications, but the acceptance rates are low. But I think when you look at the acceptance rates relative to the number of acceptances of perhaps historical periods, it's about the same time. It's just that the denominator has been increasing for many institutions as students feel, you know, a willingness and a desire to apply to more institutions. And many institutions either suspended or alleviated the requirement for prospective students to complete SATs. And so that allowed them to apply to a greater pool of institutions. But it's not that the acceptances went up anymore. In terms of enrollment pressures, we know that exists. You'll see a slide in a moment about the demographic and the enrollment cliff that is coming. We are on the precipice of that cliff, and I'll just highlight some learnings and some signals there that we see. On the risk to monitor, the S&P's chief U.S. economist forecasts a shallow recession in 2023. That's a little vague. What does that mean? It means there will be some market contraction. Household balance sheets will continue to feel the strain, and I'll get into that again as we move forward to today's presentation. But the labor market will remain strong. And so we will be almost at a full employment, you know, 6%, there'll be no more of 6% unemployed in the country. And I think all of us have experienced in our day jobs and even our own interactions, you know, just how hard it is to get people to work. So let's move forward to the next slide here to fill open positions, excuse me. So I want just to give you some of the trends that we're all watching. And there's one bonus trend that I'll include here, and I'll tell you why I left it off. But the first is the inflation and recessionary pressures. There's no doubt, and you've heard this throughout Matt's opening remarks and my comments that follow here, Really, it's getting harder to be a profitable institution. Operating costs and budgets continue to be strained. And in large part, that's by the costs of payroll costs. Payroll costs represent probably 50 to 60% of our overall statement of activities in any given year. And those costs have been increasing dramatically as we seek to retain and also attract top-level talent to fill open positions. In terms of the enrollment demand, as we mentioned, I think there's a lot of discussion afoot and narrative that individuals and prospective students are saying, you know, is the value proposition there? There's so many available open positions right now, whether they be in vocations or trades or other places, where they're saying, does it make sense to actually receive the return on our college and higher education? And Matt made a very good point that we know it often does. In terms of the operations after federal relief funding, that helped buoy many institutions. And on the slide in a moment, I'll talk more about that. But we know that is going away. And what we're going to be left with is the enrollment cliff and higher operating costs. Though the confluence of those two factors is definitely going to present some headwinds for colleges and universities. Even the wealthiest of private institutions are certainly seeing the challenges of increasing operating budgets. The balance sheet flexibility is something that actually increased quite significantly during the period of COVID. We saw institutions buoy their cash balances. We saw those institutions that held investments see them rise rather significantly during the period of COVID, which was perhaps counterfactual to what many would have thought when we're in the midst of a worldwide pandemic here. So credit quality bifurcation, it's very easy. The stronger the institution it was going into the COVID, the stronger it came out. For the less fortunate institutions that are not as wealthy, that don't have as strong of enrollment, that are totally tuition driven, they're going to continue to be challenged by the headwinds that are aloft here. Consolidation and closure, I think we already covered. Event risk, difficult to manage, difficult to predict, hard to react to. Cyber breaches, management turnover, governance scandals, you know, and that takes me to kind of the banner of this slide around enterprise risk management. Whenever Matt and I and my other partners are speaking with audit committees of colleges and universities, enterprise risk management is always on the agenda in terms of an area of focus. And many of the risks that I've identified here on this slide are included on that registry, and committees and management are constantly modeling and being attentive to these concerns. And then, of course, my bonus trend, contributions. For those institutions, mostly private institutions, but certainly public institutions alike, you know, benefited significantly during the period of the COVID from donor philanthropy. And I think in large part, it was the result of two factors. First, individuals and household balance sheets saw a rather significant increase in their personal wealth. Those that had property saw their property values increase. Those that had retirement plans or money invested in the market saw that their overall personal wealth increase. That gave them the propensity to respond to what I think the not-for-profit and colleges and universities alike did a really nice job of really amplifying the needs that they had during the period of COVID. And so actually, philanthropy was at the highest of levels over the past 3 years. But now, as we pull back, as we start to feel the pernicious impacts of inflation, we're seeing household balance sheets feel that strain. And the signals we're seeing is that donors are actually starting to pull back a little bit. And with the rising cost that both Matt and I have been talking about, even if donors give at the same historical level and consistent amounts, it's not going to be enough to make up with the shortfall of the revenues and the rising operating costs. Next slide. So now I just want to move to, there's a lot on the slide here. I just want to point out a few key metrics that we've modeled here. First, to my last point, for public institutions, tuition revenue increased by roughly 1.7%. When we look across the higher education landscape for public institutions, for privates, it went up by about 2.8%. So a small delta there. But what's important is the rate of inflation during that same period, which was 6.5%. So even if they converted those 2.8 and 1.7% increases in revenues to the bottom line, they still lost ground given the overall impacts in operating expenses. You know, for GDP for the nation is really food and fuel, but when we think about colleges and universities, to my earlier comment, it's about payroll costs. Okay, so a couple other comments here. Right in the middle of the page, we talk about investment performance. In fiscal 2021, investment performance for those that had portfolios was about 27%. But in fiscal 22, we gave back 10.6%. And in 23, we've given back almost the rest. And so over a three-year period, institutions have really found that their portfolios have actually been flat. But what that did do was it contributed to increased endowment draws, and we'll see that on a subsequent slide. Let's move forward to the next slide. So now we talked about Standard & Poor's. Let's talk about Moody's here. And I think the positive side was cash and investments for many institutions provided some financial cushion. To my comments earlier about the growth investment portfolios, most institutions drew on their lines of credit to buttress their existing cash balances, so they had a little bit more flexibility to weather any additional crises or downturns. The COVID pandemic overall wasn't as harmful to colleges and universities as originally thought. And again, it's as a result of the federal financial aid and supplements that were surged to colleges and universities, to my opening remark. Two, it was the strength of donor philanthropy that I mentioned. And three, it really had to do with the performance of the investment market. Those three factors really buttressed and supported colleges and universities during the period of the pandemic. Nobody would have thought that was going to be the case in February of 2020. In terms of risk to monitor, certainly the inflation, labor shortages, no surprise there. As you can see, thematically, there's a good amount of commonality between what S&P is saying versus what is Moody's saying. Operating budgets for most institutions will remain strained. But what I am hearing, what I am seeing, is institutions are actually starting to add back budget. They're doing the things that Matt mentioned a moment ago. They're adding back budget to those areas of their operations, those programs that make them stand out amongst their peers, that make them more recognizable and attractive to prospective students and or even current ones. Let's move to the next slide. So in terms of this particular slide, what we're really doing here is modeling revenues versus expenses. Now, we've included academic medical centers as part of this presentation, but what I would say is just focus on the lime green color and the sky blue. To the extent that the lime blue in 2020, for example, exceeds the sky blue, that represents margin for an institution. Okay, and you can see in 2019 that lines were fairly close. We're only looking really to see that revenues exceed expenses by 2 to 3% when we look at our core operating performance as an institution. But then something dramatic happens starting in 2021 when we are in the depths of the pandemic and we're focused on just looking at our operating revenues less our operating expenses. The inverse occurs. And for 2023, in light of the challenges that we're talking about in terms of inflation, declines in the market value, no federal support, look at the delta and the chasm that exists between the light blue line and the lime green. This says that institutions are really going to struggle here in terms of their operating performance overall. Next slide. So on this next slide here, it just gives you a little bit of a schematic in terms of the revenue sources for institutions. On the left-hand side, not probably very different than your own institution in terms of the composition of the revenue sources and inflows of cash for your institution. Overall, it's going to remain relatively consistent. When we look at where 23 is projected, 22 estimates at this point that have been finalized compared to 21, the sources of revenues are going to be the same. No real significant changes. As a public institution, we're going to rely heavily on state appropriations to certainly support the operating characteristics and budget of the organization. On the right-hand side here, what I think is important is we look at the trend line in terms of the performance of public institutions. In 2018, almost 50% of institutions had a surplus. They were achieving that greater than 2 to 3 to 5% operating margin from their core operating activities. In 21, it increased even more, and that is because, again, of all the market performance, in part donor dollars, a smaller component for public institutions, but also the federal dollars. But now at 23, when we turn off those three spigots and they don't have that support coming in, the number of institutions that will experience deficits has actually, it's that for 23, it's almost the sum of the past 4 years. So it does certainly punctuate the need for institutions to be very mindful about revenue growth, discounting, and expense containment. Next slide. So just a little bit of a summary in terms of in performance. Let's just focus on the blues here because that's focused on public institutions. As you can see, the amount of cash and investments that public institutions either directly or through their foundations remain relatively consistent over the five-year period that's presented here. What I think is of note is the increase in the endowment draws. Now, for most institutions, it's about 4% in terms of relieving their operating budget. In some institutions, it's almost less than that. It peaked in 2022 here, and it's expected to go down in 2023. You know, for most institutions, when we look across the higher education landscape, the effective draw on their endowments was about 4.9%. That's the amount that they actually pulled from their endowment under their spending policies. And while that tells a story, it doesn't tell the whole story. Most institutions, private in particular, buttressed their existing spending policy formulas and drew a rather significant additional amount out of their quasi-endowments to support their operations during the period of COVID. But now they don't have the capacity to continue to do that because they're eroding their investment base, and therefore they're reverting back to their more traditional spending policies that are going to be in the 4.5 to 5% range. And that's exactly what's being projected here for 2023. But again, overall, for public institutions, we don't see this as a significant source of revenue or budget relieving inflow. Next slide. Okay, so here's the headline that I mentioned earlier about the demographic enrollment cliff. And we are just on the precipice on it here of going up to the highest point in 2026, where we're going to see the highest levels of enrollment, and then we're going to see the decline occur. And that's going to continue steadily all the way for the next 15 years. This is of significance to institutions. This will challenge the operating budgets. This will challenge the revenue structures. This will challenge and also facilitate additional consolidations and mergers of institutions. But here's the thing, a couple takeaways of note here. And I just share this, not that it's particularly relevant to your institution, but as I'm talking to my counterparts overseas and our other Grant Thornton firms that work with higher education, particularly in England, they're experiencing a bumper crop of high school graduates. In fact, they think that it's going to be quite the reverse of what actually we're experiencing here in the United States. Why that's the case, I'm not sure, but it's just a helpful data point to suggest that juxtaposition between what we're experiencing or expect to experience here in the U.S. versus what's happening perhaps in Europe. I also wanted to make a note that, you know, one way to solve this is not only through, you know, expanding equity and access for individuals and students, but to also recognize two things. First, there's 39 million people in the United States that have some level of college credit. And so if we can tap into that individual base and try to bring more of those individuals back to campus, that can certainly help our revenue base. The other comment here that is of note is that as of today, there's over a million less students enrolled in higher education than pre-pandemic. And so if we can do more to get those students to be back on campus or enroll in education in whatever modality they find is going to be helpful and responsive to their current life circumstances, that too will greatly help this enrollment cliff. Let's move to the next slide. Okay, so just a little bit of a view in terms of what we expect based on the models that have been provided to us. You know, it's good to know that, you know, there's 14 green states, and so they're actually anticipating an increase in the number of enrollees. There's 10 states that are actually coded red. What's of note is that 20% of those are fairly close to where we are here in Nevada. But this gives you some perspective, at least just broadly across the nation, where we think those declines are going to exist. Now, of course, those declines are actually more pronounced than the increases that we expect in some of those other states. Next slide. So just before I wrap up here, you know, I know this is really hard to see, and hopefully the slides will be made available to everyone post today's presentation, but I would just focus you on the second column from the left here, public four-year institutions. For each year over since 2018, they've seen a reduction except during 2020. And I think in 2020, we saw a slight uptick, less than 1% here. But really what that is that there was a good amount of students that actually left private institutions to take advantage of the public institutions that may have been closer to their home during the period of the pandemic. So that allowed them to continue their education, but overall, really not of a material nature. The takeaway here is that we're looking across the board, we're seeing declines in all types of institutions for post-secondary education. Next slide. And so I want to talk about discount rates, something that's very important. I know you'll hear a lot of fiscal officers of institutions talk about this. For the first time, we've actually eclipsed 54% in terms of looking at first-time, full-time undergraduate enrollees. That is the discount rate from the sticker price, 54.5%. When we consider the entire landscape of enrollees, it's about 49%. The difference between those two, undergraduates versus first-time enrollees, has roughly stayed pretty consistent at around 5%. Now, again, this tells a story, but not necessarily the whole story, because most institutions are increasing their top-line revenue, but we need to look at the net revenue per student. And I think the following slide is more helpful in that regard. So on the next slide, we look at net revenue. And so while we've had a pretty good run here over the last 10 years in terms of translating those increases in top line revenue to the bottom line or contributing to margin, in 2021 and 22, when we needed it most, it wasn't there for us. And so most institutions increased the sticker price to attend the institution, but wound up having to give it back through discount and other forms of scholarships that actually reduce the net revenue per student for those institutions. That's the number that fiscal officers, and I know provost, deans, and enrollment officers are looking at. Let's move to the next slide. So I just wanted to close with some comments here. And, you know, for those of you that really track higher education very, very closely, some of what's on this slide is actually outdated already because of what's been happening recently in the news. First, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about the student debt relief plan for those students that or those individuals that may have outstanding loans. You know, there's about 20 million individuals out there that actually have outstanding debt and have not completed their degree. The majority of those individuals are making less than $75,000 a year, have less than $50,000 outstanding in terms of debt. Now, I know this is moving slowly through the channels of approval. We'll see what happens. We'll certainly keep you apprised in future presentations what happens here. The FAFSA Simplification Act was delayed. It's now going to take effect. It's streamlining some of the questions, selective service, drug convictions, et cetera. The intent and focus of this is really to make aid more readily available to students so that they can participate in higher education. It's also changing what was previously known as the expected family contribution to a student index number to help institutions determine how much aid to award to eligible students. And then finally on this slide, just mentioned Pell. You know, Pell is roughly $7,400 per year for students that are eligible to receive it, looking to increase that by about another $800 to bring it for the first time over $8,200. That could be very helpful and material to those individuals and families that are looking to help defray the cost of attending an institution. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it back to Matt to wrap up our presentation.
Matt Unterman for the record from Grant Thornton. I'll just pause. Chair Perkins, should we ask if there's any questions?
Thank you. Are there any questions from any members or any regents present? Okay, moving right along, Matt.
Great. Thank you, Chair Perkins. So Matt Unterman for the record, Grant Thornton. We'll proceed with the conclusion. Next slide, please. So I think Dennis provided a lot of great financial, particularly insights there across higher education, what's been happening. As we talked about in the first part of our presentation, it's really an interesting time in the state of higher education. And I would summarize it, many institutions are concerned as the future. I would describe it as a bit of an opportunity. It's an opportunity to think about how do we invest? How do we grow? How do we serve our missions? How do we serve our states? And so I would conclude with this presentation with a brief few slides in summarizing, frankly, a lot of the financials that Dennis presented and the opening questions that I presented, kind of concluding with some things that you may consider. So if you can go to the next slide. So these are the questions that we posed 20 minutes ago. Where are we as a state? What's our ideal future? Where are we headed? What gets in the way of achieving where we would like to be as a state? What investments in higher education as a critical tool toward the growth of our state to realize that future? These are the three questions, and I would like to maybe pose this opportunity in a series of other questions. And I can pose it to you as a state, I can pose it to other states, but focusing on Nevada here. So why are we where we are from a post-secondary perspective versus where Lumina has set its goals? And by the way, Regent Cruz Crawford, just letting you know, one of the wonderful things about a publicly streaming live event is, you know, there's accountability of public speaking. People do some fact checking live for you. And so just to report, those numbers that I did share with you is anything after high school. So associate's degrees were included in the county's information that's came to me here. So, but I think, you know, thinking about, you know, why are we at where we are versus 60%? No state has really effectively studied this. No state has determined who is showing up on our doorsteps in higher education and who is not. Who is making their way through graduation and who is not. Who is actually graduating equitably in our higher education institutions and who is not. It's not always about access to the higher eds, it's about completion. It's not always about completion, it's about equitable outcomes at the time of completion. And there are various factors out there that prevent all the people with opportunities out there from achieving an equitable completion of post-secondary education, which is what truly drives growth within a state. And again, I would say this is something that no state has effectively studied, could be an opportunity for the state of Nevada to consider. So let's go to the next slide here. So again, we're looking, it's not about access. Student success is about equitable outcomes. And this is a framework we could talk a whole hour about here. This is our framework for educational equity. It starts at the total market and goes down to the total addressable market and the serviceable equitable market. Basically, it's who's eligible for post-secondary education, the gray or light purple there, the dark purple, who actually applies post-secondary, the maroon is those who are accepted and enroll, the dark green, those who persist and complete their post-secondary credentials, and the lighter green, those who complete them equitably. Equitable completion means depending on your race, your gender, all kinds of different things in your background, you have the opportunity for success just like somebody else. The same GPA, the same post-college compensation, there's nothing in your way of achieving equity in that regard. And I think this is a framework that we've employed, taking that quote-unquote customer lens to say across our state, who has the opportunity to be successful, who should have the opportunity, who currently has the opportunity. And I would dare say that every one of these things, every one of these squares, there's inequity built in. There's inequity built in that has not been effectively studied and reversed. And to get from where we are today in terms of our post-secondary achievement to where we need to be, we need to study that equity and inequity to achieve better post-secondary outcomes. So next slide, please. So we've actually have a white paper that's going to be released shortly. And this white paper talks about various factors that get in the way of someone showing up at the doorstep of higher education and proceeding towards completion and proceeding towards completion with equity. And there are various factors, there's five across the top here, that enable support or get in the way of a student's or potential student's achievement. Obviously in the world of academics, finances, health, sense of belonging, post-college, there's a lot of different elements to be unpacked there. But those are the elements that either enable through support success or disable or get in the way established barriers. And so we then take a look at the bottom half of that slide. We look at various institutions and not just higher education institutions, but various factors and institutions that are in our lives that either enable success, reverse prior wrongs or challenges, or inhibit success. So these are boosters, these are inhibitors and blockers. Boosters we see this as helping an individual progress equitably towards the next stage or the opportunity. An inhibitor allows them to progress, but maybe inequitably. A blocker stops their progress in their tracks. And this might make more sense as I talk more about it. In fact, we see there to be four different realms that are affecting the success of higher education institutions or who shows up on our doorsteps. There's societal realm, an interpersonal realm, a personal realm, as well as an institutional realm. Societal realm, but the things that are just happening holistically within our society that allow someone to become a post-secondary student. Interpersonal, there's always things in our families or social lives that are enabling our achievement or disabling our achievement. And there are things that are happening on a just personal level on the same level. And institutions have the ability to identify students, support students, and reverse some of those prior challenges and enable them through boosters to enable their achievement. This is through tutoring, through advising, through appropriate instruction, through writing centers, through supporting them financially where they have challenges with food inequity, food insecurity, all kinds of different programs that allow them to be successful and achieve equitable outcomes. Or institutions have a way of not identifying those students and allowing food insecurity, housing imbalance, inadequate childcare, et cetera, get in the way of someone's achievement of a post-secondary outcome and a post-secondary outcome that's equitable. Okay, so the next slide kind of models this out for us. You know, we always get this question, well, why in the United States are only 35% of 18 to 22 year olds in college at any time? Why do only 65% graduate in 6 years? What is happening here? And for you as a state to consider how you as regents can reverse the trend and how you could achieve growth in your post-secondary outcomes, this is a model to consider. Okay, this will all be documented and published publicly in our white paper. We're looking at first is the societal, interpersonal, and personal institutional realms. We're going to look at this. Second click on this slide, if you can, is the belief that every individual has an equal opportunity for success, regardless of their backgrounds or demographics. I'm hoping we all agree with this premise, but we, of course, not every individual is able to achieve success based on various things that get in their way. And these things are either enabling someone through a booster or inhibiting their success or blocking, okay? So the first one we're seeing here is this student. Everything was going their way. The wind was at their back. Green all the way. Society favored them. Interpersonally, they had the right support networks. In the personal, things are going well. And the institution, frankly, didn't have to do much programmatically to achieve graduation with equitable outcomes. This student is green across the board. Now, the next one, if you click again, is there's some good things happening. There's some maybe some challenges on the personal front, but the university or the student enabled some support structure and reversed that trend and enabled that student to move from yellow to green to create equity where there could have been inequity. Next row is not so successful. We have inequity persisting at many different levels, societal, interpersonal, personal, and the institution failed to identify the opportunity, failed to provide a service to support and achieve equitable outcomes. Now, the student may have graduated, which is good. We see those charts and graphs from before. Graduation is good, but equitable graduation, equitable outcomes is really where it's at. So there's a missed opportunity to create equity. Next row, even worse. There's some challenges along the way, societal challenges, interpersonally, maybe a really supportive family and structures that allowed them to, you know, reverse the trends, but there's some personal challenges. And unfortunately, they weren't reversed at the institutional level. There weren't the adequate programs. The student didn't get matched with the programs and that student stopped out. They did not graduate. You know, only 65% of across the US students graduate in 6 years. This is what happens. They're just not enabled to achieve success. Even though they walk in the door, they stop out. There's a reduction of equity. In fact, there's not the completion of their graduation or degree. Next click, not every student makes it to higher ed. There's some problems along the way in societal, interpersonal, personal. There's some things that are just serve as blockers that even prevent them from considering themselves to have the ability to apply, the ability to get in, the ability to feel that they can make it, or maybe they don't make it and they're not accepted and they don't have the opportunity to get a post-secondary degree. Those students are not blocked at the institutional level, they are blocked across several different realms. And so we ask ourselves societally, not just in the state of Nevada, but across the US, why do only 35% of our 18 to 20 year olds attend post-secondary education at any one time? We see a distribution here. Why do only 65% graduate within 6 years? We now have a model to understand this. But again, what I would say is no state has effectively studied this to figure out how they can dissect ways to improve outcomes with customers, their current customers, or potential customers. So why aren't we at 60% today? Why aren't we getting enough students in the door to a higher education institution when in reality, our role is to serve the state and its economic viability and societal viability? And why, when students get in the door, are they not graduating or not graduating equitably? These are important things to study. Institutions, unfortunately, are not always equipped to study these things. Even at the institutional level, when inadequately resourced, they are certainly not able to do this. So this is an area to for you all to consider, where do we want to be as a state? How do we move forward? And so I'll close with the next slide here, which is the questions that I asked before. Oop, growing equitable outcomes. So let me, this is one more slide. Click again, please. So this is the idea of 44% on the right. And the way to solve this one more click is to look at each of those boxes on the left and to grow, one more click, please, to grow each of the boxes, the equitable outcomes, the outcomes, every one of those boxes to achieve an even broader potential customer base and actual customer base, those that come in the door. Okay, one click ahead. Beautiful. And now to the next slide. Thank you. So the questions really to consider, I think, across all the states, other states are considering, I think you're at a place to really consider for your unique population. Where are we as a state currently? What's our ideal future? What barriers are inhibiting our states and potential students' ideal future? What investments in education are required to realize that future? I think it is a wonderful and exciting time in the world of higher education. As Dennis described, there's been some financial challenges. We've encountered things we've never encountered before. On the other hand, there's an upside. There's an opportunity to really take all these different factors of technology, of interest in ESG and DE&I, and looking at financial opportunities for replacing reductions in net tuition revenue, looking at ways to actually serve our constituents, serve our state in a different way. I think we have maybe one more slide here, slide 35. So this is opportunity for some Q&A. If we do have maybe 5-10 minutes left, we'd love to see if any of the regents have any questions for us or would like to have any discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Uteman. Any questions? Regent Cruz Crawford, please.
Madam Chair,
I'm in the queue too. This is Regent Del Carlo. I texted.
Thank you. Then we'll go Regent Cruz Crawford, then Regent Del Carlo, and then Regent Boylan.
So I just, Regent Cruz Crawford for the record, I just want to thank you so much for this presentation. I loved it. I'm going to be referencing a lot of these materials as I make decisions and discuss things. And it really just holds a lot of weight to the work that we do, especially as regents, and to take our job, very seriously, because if we work together really well, we can make a huge difference in our students in the state of Nevada. So I just wanted to thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. And Matt and Dennis, I can't thank you enough either. And Matt, I have to go back on those slides you had a while back on that one presentation. I didn't think ever gave you enough time to properly give your presentations, because your information is the best researched. You use all the big organizations like SHIO and NACUBA, and this is what we need to be looking at. And as you both were speaking, all I could think about, I don't know if you follow Nevada really closely, but we just finished our legislative session and we had a bill passed that we're going to have a formula study done between our legislative sessions, because we only meet every 2 years for 120 days. And I've said it since I've been on this board and have learned that our funding formula is not equitable. It's not at all. It's very university centric. We are a system that includes 4 community colleges, and our community colleges greatly suffer from the formula study, so much to the point that we're even looking at the term consolidation or merger, whatever you want to call it, between an R1 institution and a community college. So I'm wondering, with all the research you have, with the white paper you've got coming, does your company also have consultants that come out and help? Would they be able to come help us do our formula study through our legislature? I'm not sure. Maybe the acting chancellor will have to jump in. I'm not sure how these interim committees work, because there's got to be outside experts that come into these committees. But everything you're talking about, when you started talking about how inequitable it is, I've been saying that. How can you have our students go to school when they've got, many times, of course, they don't have enough to eat, maybe. They don't have ways to get there. They've got elderly parents that they're taking care of. They've got their own children that they need taking care of. We've got all of our institutions that have child care centers have 2-year waiting lists. UNLV was just fortunate to get a $5 million anonymous donation to expand the capacity. But all of our institutions need that. And really, in Nevada, until we can get all these equitable issues taken care of, we are going to be on the hamster wheel forever. And you see how low we are in so many things. And you said there's not a state that has taken this model or done anything. I mean, it's not my decision wholly. I'm just one of 13, blah, blah. But this is what we need. Honest to God, this is the greatest thing I've heard. If we could incorporate all the things you're doing through Lumina and get this study done properly, I think we're finally going to have the proper answers to why Nevada is so low and have the right solutions going into the future, because we are a growing state. We're not going to stop growing. Too many people want to come here. Our tax structures are too lucrative. And Las Vegas is going to, there's never going to be another Las Vegas. It just attracts too many wonderful things. So I just am so appreciative of what you've done today. Thank you so much. And to Carrie, I would ask that we have all the Grant Thornton educational studies added to our library, so all of us, especially our new regents, can go back and read their reports. Thank you very much.
Very well said, Regent DiCarlo and Regent Boylan. Go ahead, Mr. Unman. Go ahead and answer those questions.
All right.
I just wanted to quickly reply, Matt Unterman for the record from Grant Thornton. So first of all, Regent DiCarlo, thank you very much for your kind words, and also Regent Cruz Crawford. It's wonderful. We're here to make a difference, as you can tell. We care about making a difference. We care about making a difference, period, and the state of Nevada. So thanks for the opportunity to do that. You know, this is a methodology. We really do believe that no state has effectively studied this in order to reverse trends and to seize the opportunity. And we're thrilled to hear that Nevada is taking steps towards that. We certainly would be happy to have a conversation with you and to support your effort going forward. It would just be our honor to be able to be a part of that process and to better serve the state.
Thank you for that. Go ahead, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, ma'am. I'll try and keep this short and sweet like myself. I won't try and say too much because we saw so much. I have a thought mixed up with a question. All this stuff, I'm so glad that they presented this. And it's like when someone asks you, you know, do you want to read this book? And first thing you say is, does it have pictures in there? So I like all the graphs and all those kind of things. They help me a lot. I also like the fact that one of you said Nevada. Even I don't say Nevada. But anyway, it sounds good. Now, my whole thought is we've been told, I think, that we are screwed, and we are 62nd among 50 states, or something like that. We are so far behind, so bad. And that's all very nice, because I think we're getting used to being 94th among 50 states, or something like that, in everything, which is a shame. So to me, everything is great looking forward, but how do we do that? Obviously, there was a guy called Einstein, I think, an old buddy of mine. And he said, if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, we're going to get the same results. And that's the height of stupidity. And that's what it seems like to me. This is great information. It's very nice. But now, what do we do with it? We've had these kind of presentations before from other people who've come in. And like Regent DiCarlo said, this is something that we need to work on. And she's been saying this for a while, I know that. I think we need to make some changes and stop the status quo of everything that we do the same old way. So I thank you, gentlemen, for the amazing information. You know, I would have loved to have stolen this for a PhD thesis or something like that. That would be terrific. And I love all the information. I love the pictures. But the question is, Madam Chair, fellow regents, how do we go forward? And what do we do with this? I know it's a big thing. Don't tell me it's for new business, Madam Chair. No. Please.
You know me well. That's exactly what I was going to say, yes, is that we can have that as another topic or maybe a workshop.
Okay, there you go. Now, that's good. I like that. Thank you so much. But, gentlemen, great job. I appreciate all that information. And it's Nevada, not Nevada. All right.
And we mispronounce words all the time, many words, including the state's name. So apologies. So.
Thank you so much. Regent Carvalho?
I don't have anything to add to this. Thank you.
And I'll move right to your next door to Regent Brown.
Appreciate you. Regent Brown, for the record. So I have a lot of notes here. Kind of looks like a little bit of a beautiful mind, so I'm going to unpack this a little. So I really liked the three questions that you proposed. Where are we as a state currently? And, you know, I work in economic development in Clark County, and I know that we're working off numbers that say, like, only 35% of Clark County residents have any type of higher ed credentialing. You know, this is where our community partners come in, focusing on workforce at the community college level, talking about stacking credentials and things like that. I think those are all conversations that we should be having. Because at the end of the day, our higher ed institutions are our workforce pipeline. So when I went to your second question of, like, what are the barriers, you know, I always look back and say, you know, I'm actually the first graduating class that entered high school here in Nevada knowing that they were going to get the Millennium Scholarship if they did well. And so that's only a decade removed. That's two decades removed. Two decades. That's one generation removed. And so as a state, we've only invested in higher ed for 20 plus years. You know, and we had bookends of a decade that we saw two crises, the economic crisis and a pandemic. And so, you know, what are our barriers? I think just knowing that we've, as a state, only really invested for 20 years, we've had two global pandemics and an economic crisis. So how do we answer that third question of what investments? And what I would love to do is take this information that we saw and commit as a board to be working with the school districts so we can start having a conversation that's K through 16 and not just, you know, how do we graduate people and get them into our higher ed institutions? Expanding CTE, dual enrollment, expand pre-K and early childhood education, and even growing our cooperative extension programs. Those are all things that I would like for us to kind of think about as we use the data in this. And so that's all I wanted to share.
Thank you for that comment. Regent Cruz Crawford.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. You told me you didn't know how to wordsmith that, and you did an excellent job. So, one question from constituents is they would like information, some more demographic information, including first-gen immigrant students in the data. So that's just a request for next time we get a report.
Thank you. I'll move that to new business. Any other questions from any regent or? Okay, thank you. And with that, since thank you so much. I appreciate Grant Thornton so much for all the information they provide us and all the support they provide this crew.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Thank you. Okay.
And that, I know, I have to indulge because I am running over time, but the presentation was so informative and had so much information that I apologize up front. So, and with that, that was information only. Awesome. New business. We have a lot. I have a list going. So if. I'm going to transfer everything that was said earlier for new business and just put it into new business. That'll save us about 30 seconds there. Thank you. So new business gone. Public comment. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. I just had one item for suggested new business, if that's okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Given the already established change in leadership audits and the recent LCB audits that we just had, I would like to pose a question or a suggestion to our internal audit staff to maybe contemplate an exit audit or change in business officer leadership, since that's something that would be an area for greater transparency and accountability. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I will add that also. We were thinking along those same lines because we were losing so many business officers. So thank you for that. And is that all the new business? Awesome. Next, public comment. Is there any public comment? I see coming on up, Reno. Let's start with Reno.
Kent Irvin, I'm a faculty member at UNR and past president of the Nevada Faculty Alliance. I appreciate the discussion in Agenda Item 6 on Title IX case reporting. The system hotline is the tip of the iceberg. Most Title IX complaints and investigations happen at the institutional level. There needs to be transparent statistical reporting on the number and types of cases, how they are resolved, and how long the investigations take. We often hear of investigations that taking many months or longer. Justice delayed is justice denied and can allow harassment or other negative situations to persist. The region should ask for full and uniform Title IX case reporting for students and staff from each institution, and you should ask for compliance audits of the processes. Only then can you evaluate whether there are systematic trends and take corrective action to protect all members of the NC community. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more public comment in Reno? Is there any public comment in Elko?
There is no public comment in Elko.
Thank you. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
There's no public comment in Las Vegas.
Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of our meeting. And it's now adjourned. Thank you so much.